and welcome to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wary, Associate Editor for McLean's Magazine.
Two major resignations this week that are changing the political landscape of the country. First off, after 8 years as the only finance minister under this conservative government, Jim Flaherty quits cabinet and is quickly replaced by Joe Oliver. What is Flaherty's legacy and what challenge has he left for Oliver? We're joined by Don Drummond, a former finance official and former chief economist for TD Bank.
After months of scandal, Alberta Premier Alison Redford has decided to resign.
I am not prepared to allow party and caucus infighting to get in the way of building a better future for our province.
The opposition Wild Rose leader in Alberta, Danielle Smith, is here to discuss the resignation, a possible snap election, and her hope to end the 43-year dynasty of the PC party in that province.
A landmark ruling from the Supreme Court of Canada. In a 6-1 decision, the Prime Minister's appointment to the top court, Justice Marc Nadon, has been rejected. Joining us is Emmett McFarlane, an assistant professor and the author of a book on the politics of the country's high court.
And later in the show, the McLean's panel weighs in on the top stories of the week.
For your politics, for your power, welcome to the Hill. It started with a swearing-in ceremony on February 6, 2006, and it all ended on Tuesday with a simple written statement. After 8 years as Canada's finance minister, Jim Flaherty resigned from cabinet, going out with a whisper. It truly is the end of an era in Canadian politics. Up until this week, Flaherty had been the only finance minister that Prime Minister Stephen Harper had ever named.
The 64-year-old said his decision to leave politics was not related to health problems stemming from a rare skin disorder. Instead, he says after discussing his future with his family, he has decided to return to the private sector. But as quickly as Flaherty was gone, his replacement was in place.
Wednesday morning, former Natural Resources Minister Joe Oliver took over the reins as the man in charge of our country's finances. But after his swearing-in ceremony, Oliver refused to talk to the media, ignoring questions from the reporters shouting at him from 10 feet away.
Mr. Oliver, come.
In fact, the government kept the whole ceremony secret, not announcing when it would happen and not allowing cameras or reporters inside to see the event.
We requested interviews with both Oliver and Flaherty, but were told neither of them are available. We are able to speak with Don Drummond, who worked in the Federal Finance Department for 23 years before becoming the chief economist with TD Bank in 2000, a role he held for a decade. He speaks with Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes about the legacy of Jim Flaherty and the biggest challenge facing Joe Oliver, income splitting.
So Don, you know as much about the pressures of budget making and managing the economy out of the Finance Department as anybody. When people look back at Jim Flaherty's era there, I guess inevitably they're going to think about the fall of 2008, early 2009, dealing with the financial meltdown and crisis. What's your thoughts on how that was handled? Did you see him as having shone in that moment? Were there shortcomings in the way he handled it? What's your perspective?
Well, I think if we look back at now from 2014, Canada came out of that relatively well. They put the emphasis on relative because obviously we had a very deep recession and an awful lot of people got thrown in unemployment, but if you compare it to what happened in Europe, or even if you compare it certainly in the labor market to the United States, and certainly what happened to the financial institutions, we came out of it quite well. I think we always have to realize that Canadian banks were risk-averse. They've often been criticized for that. They have a pretty oligopolistic structure. They don't have the competition in the United States, and they've been criticized for that too. But both of those features helped enormously. They were running an awful lot of capital, and they weren't running the leverage ratios anywhere near what was happening in Europe and the United States. So the government has definitely helped the financial institutions and the economy, but I would say the state of the financial institutions definitely helped the government look good as well.
On the state of the federal balance sheet, there has been some discussion, I know from people who watched the trajectory of the Flaherty years and saying that, geez, he would have been a lot better shape going into 2009 had he not shaved those 2 points off the GST in earlier budgets. What's your view on that?
Well, I look at the GST cut, and from both perspectives, yes, the deficits would have been lower, the debt burden would have been lower, and that would have helped. But I also think if you're going to reduce taxes by $12 billion, and if you thought that was the right thing to do, I would certainly not have liked to have seen that done through the GST. I think when you're reducing taxes, you want not only to put money back into people's pockets, but you want to get rid of some of the strong disincentives that are associated with taxes. There isn't really any strong disincentives associated with the GST. The extent it gives a disincentive is not to spend money, but encouraging people to save is actually a good thing. I think the target we have in Canada should have been on the personal income tax. We pay very high personal income taxes, and it really provides a disincentive for some people to work. So I would say, yeah, maybe better not to have spilt the $12 billion at all, but if you were going to reduce taxes by that extent, I certainly would have preferred to have seen it done on the personal income tax than the GST.
Flaherty's personal style was interesting. He waded in, for example, on his concerns about a possible housing bubble. Some people thought that was maybe not the role of the finance department or the finance minister, that should be left more to the Bank of Canada governor. What do you think about that? Was Flaherty too outspoken there? Was he a force for good?
On the role of the housing market, that was absolutely the responsibility of the Ministry of Finance. And in fact, you could rewind back earlier than that, because the controversy really got started when David Dodge, when he was the governor, made some comments of his concerns of the housing market. And he got it thrown in his face that perhaps that wasn't his place to mention that. And he got things stirring, but he kind of publicly at least quieted down on that and left it to the Minister of Finance. No, I think it was absolutely the right thing. But it's another thing. Almost every step that Mr. Flaherty did, there's always a but on the other hand. On the other hand, in this case, is have to bear in mind, he was the minister who liberated the mortgage requirements first before he ultimately tightened them. So to a good extent, he was undoing what he had done previously. The Liberals had started it before the Conservatives came into power, before Minister Flaherty became the Minister of Finance. But he took a kick at it as well, making it easier for people to get mortgages with extremely little money down. And then I think realized that was a mistake and unwound that stuff.
He sort of went further. He kind of got religion on that subject of making sure we didn't end up inflating a housing bubble.
Well, it got ridiculous that we used to have the requirement to get insurance on your mortgage. You needed a 5% down payment, and then one of the liberalization steps allowed you to effectively borrow the 5%. So you literally had not a single cent involved in it. And meanwhile, we were watching these reverse mortgages in California, where the amount of the principal went up over time, and you realize those all crumbled because it turned out housing prices could actually go down. No one really had thought about that.
It's funny. One of the hallmarks, I would think, of the Flaherty era, at least for those of us covering budgets, was that budgets became much more of a public relations exercise. You know, they weren't even called budgets anymore. They were called economic action plans, you know. And do you even care about that side of it? I mean, does it matter to you whether or not the budget process becomes more of a show and less of a dry exercise in explaining the numbers?
Well, I worked on preparing the budgets for 23 years, so it's hard to get it completely out of my bloodstream. So actually, I do care. I don't really care about that aspect too much. But what really struck me over the last number of years is budget documents have actually got longer, but they contain less and less information.
And yeah, I can't understand
them. They contain startlingly little information.
It's true. What? Why is that? I mean, is that something we should be more outraged about than we are?
Well, I think we could. I mean, as to give an example, we do not know as of 2014 where most of the departments are going to make their spending cuts that they were given 3 years ago. We do not really have any idea how the government managed to not spend $7 billion of money that Parliament authorized to spend in this current fiscal year that's almost over. All we get is a shrug. No one really knows. That's a lot of money to go missing. What happened? Was it planned? Was it all in one department? Was it spread across departments? Was it they found efficiencies and didn't need it? Or did they cut some valuable services? I have no idea. And apparently Parliament doesn't seem to be so inclined to look into that. But you won't ever find that sort of information in budgets, which I think used to be in there.
Yeah. It was. Don, there's another element here that's top of mind for people around the Ottawa bubble, and that's the fact that Flaherty had this interesting public sparring match with the Prime Minister and other people in Cabinet over income splitting late in the game here. Could you talk to both the substance of that debate and then maybe a little bit, if you care to, on the optics of a finance minister stepping out like that?
Well, it's highly relevant for his successor because his successor has a two-step procedure that's the script that he's been given. The first is to preside over a return-to-balanced budget and, in fact, by the 2015 budget, be able to credibly show there will be at least a modest surplus so he can give away some goodies. And the second step is then to decide upon and deliver those goodies. And the goodies that have always been in the shelf have been income splitting and a doubling of the tax-free savings account allowance. The thing about income splitting is it's expensive. It delivers a very large benefit to a very select group of people, that select group of people being couples that have a big disparity in their income. I would love it. Oddly enough, I was probably the primary beneficiary of the introduction of income splitting when it applied to pensions, because I have a federal government pension and my wife doesn't. And we split that, and it saves me a lot of money. But you have to ask the question, was I really the target audience? Should I be the target audience for something like that? For single people and for married couples, the income is more equal. This is not going to do anything for them. So it's quite divisive and quite expensive, so I'm not surprised to see there's a lot of controversy over that. Minister Flaherty, of course, was fairly unique in the cabinet of saying something against the total government script. He didn't really say anything against it. He kind of mused that maybe it wasn't such a great idea. We haven't heard many ministers do that, but the Prime Minister confirmed his interest. So I suppose the new minister, that will be the script that he's expected to follow, but there will be a lot of controversy over the next year about whether that's a good... I mean, just as there was with the GST cut, is that really the best way to spill a couple of billion dollars?
Don, it sounds like you're advising Joe Oliver to find a way to back away from that one.
I'm hurting my self-interest in saying so, because that's another measure that's tailor-made for me, but I'm not quite sure I should be at the top end of the priority list for people who should be getting help. I wouldn't do it if I were them. It requires a particular politics, and you really have to decide that relatively small segment of the population is really the base that you want to appeal to, and that's a very powerful measure to do that, but there's a lot of people who aren't in that situation, and they won't take too kindly to it.
Sounds like Minister Flaherty has left his successor a bit of an issue there to deal with. Don, thank you very much for bringing us your insights today. I really appreciate it.
Hey, you're very welcome.
That's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes speaking with Don Drummond, the former chief economist for TD Bank. Stay tuned for the McLean's panel later in the show when we will look deeper into this big change in finance.
Coming up, Alberta's opposition leader joins us to talk about the resignation of Premier Alison Redford, and we take a look at the Supreme Court decision to reject the Prime Minister's appointment to the top court.
She was the first woman to serve as Premier of Alberta, but just 896 days after being sworn into office, it was all over.
I am not prepared to allow party and caucus infighting to get in the way of building a better future for our province and for all Albertans. And that is why I am announcing today that with a profound optimism for Alberta's future, I am resigning as Premier of Alberta, effective this Sunday evening.
Alison Redford calls it quits after weeks of open fighting in her caucus stemming from her lavish travel expenses and disillusionment with the direction of her government.
The Alberta PC Party now has 6 months to choose a new leader, and that person will become the new premier. But with slumping poll numbers and internal divisions, there is growing talk of the end of the PC's 43-year dynasty in the province. Joining us now on the show is the leader of the Wild Rose Party and Alberta's official opposition, Danielle Smith. It's good to have you with us.
I'm happy to be here.
First off, I want to bring you back to Wednesday night when Alison Redford resigned as Premier of Alberta. What was your reaction to her speech, and what do you think was actually behind her resignation?
I have to say, I'd given an interview just a couple of hours before where somebody asked me if I thought she was done, and I said, no, I've seen this Premier come back from just as bad poll results, and particularly in the last election. And she has a lot of fight in her, so I was very, very surprised. I would say that part of what happened was the $45,000 trip that she took to South Africa being compared against the Premier of Nova Scotia, who only spent $1,000 for that same trip to go down to Mandela's funeral. That really was a bit of a straw that broke the camel's back. And everyone who had any grievance with the Premier over the last 2 years, it just started spilling out all over the place, from party executive to party members to party presidents to caucus members. And when you face that kind of onslaught of lack of confidence, it becomes very, very difficult to turn around. The general view, though, is that the final atomic bomb that went off was the poll results from a local polling company called Think HQ that landed about noon that day, that showed that they were actually behind all three other parties in Edmonton, which is one of the major places where this premier had grown her coalition in the last election. So I think that combination of factors, losing party support, caucus support, and public support, it really was a lethal combination.
There are some suggestions, though, that sexism does play a part in this. Do you think a male leader in her position would have faced the same sort of caucus revolt that Redford went through?
I reject the notion that this has anything to do with her gender. It has a lot to do with a lot of bad decisions over the last 2 years. And let's remember that just before she came in, we had a male premier who was ousted because of low public opinion polls, lack of support within party executive, and lack of support in caucus. This is really a problem with the culture of the PC party. The culture of the PC party is cling to power at all costs. And when they start seeing that the public opinion polls aren't going their way, they take out their leader from within. So now we're plunged into another leadership vote. Again, I don't think gender has anything to do with it. I think that if a premier is not able to deliver on their agenda and manage to maintain all three of those different groups behind them, their lifespan and being able to stay in that position is pretty short.
Over the next 6 months, the PC party is going to choose a new leader and therefore a new premier of Alberta. There are a lot of names being thrown around. Some federal conservatives may be offered a chance to run. We know that there have been some conversations with people like James Rajat, who is the head of the Finance Committee federally, Michelle Rempel, a very popular MP, former Minister Jim Prentice, and then others in Alberta like Finance Minister Doug Horner, former Edmonton Mayor Stephen Mandel, even Calgary's Mayor Nahed Nenshi isn't ruling anything out at the moment. How do you prepare for some of the big names that are being thrown around right now?
I would tell my friends in the federal conservatives, and the names you mentioned are my friends, just don't do it. This party is too damaged and too wrecked to fix. I can't imagine why somebody would want to come in from the outside seeing how caucus rips apart their leaders when they start stumbling, seeing how this party rips apart their leaders when they start stumbling, and also seeing how impossible it is to implement a positive agenda of change. The problem with the party having been in power for 43 years is it's stacked with people who fell in love with decisions that they made decades ago and don't want to change them. It's the reason why we can't seem to get progress on any of the issues we're trying to raise in the legislature. I know nationally, probably what only leaks out is the entitlement issues, the political scandals, the expense scandals, the issues of ethical lapses. But what resonates in Alberta is the fact that we are spending more than virtually any other province on healthcare and getting worse results. We've got seniors who are getting abused in senior centers, and there's absolutely no accountability for addressing it. We've got a crisis of the deaths of children in care, and the government is hiding it. We've got a $3 billion cash shortfall. All of these things are systemic, deep-rooted problems that are not going to be changed by a change of leadership.
But, I mean, that was a similar argument that you made after Ed Stelmach left and Alison Redford came in, and your party was polling high then. You're polling very high right now. 46% is the Angus Reid number, while the PCs are at 23%. But still, in the last election, your party came up short. So how do you account for that, and how do you think it will even change this time around?
In the last election, I'd only been leader for just over 2 years. We'd gone from a party that had zero seats, $50,000 in the bank account, and only a handful of functioning constituency associations to running a full roster of candidates. People just didn't know who we were. And we had a couple of policies that caused us some trouble. We had a couple of candidates who made comments that alienated voters. We have spent the last 2 years rebuilding trust with Albertans. We addressed some of the issues in our policy book. We have addressed the issue of candidate selection. It's going to be a much more rigorous process. And our caucus team of 17 is incredibly strong. All of the reports, even those who are not Wild Rose fans in the media, have had to acknowledge that this government has never faced such a strong opposition. I have an incredible team in the legislature. So I think those combination of factors do not make it a shoe-in for the PCs. In the past, when you voted for the PC leader in a leadership contest, it essentially was the general election because everybody knew there wasn't another party who could replace them. That's not how people are feeling right now. And I think that we're going to continue to do what we do, putting up positive policy ideas, critiquing the government where they go wrong, and people will have a real choice in the next election.
Are you predicting that it actually will be the end of the 43-year PC dynasty? Last year, a lot of people were writing that obituary, but it never came to be. Are you going to be bold and make that prediction now?
I would have to say that if Albertans give this tired old government another mandate, I would be astonished. We have now 8 years, and we're on our third premier. We had Premier Klein left, then we had Premier Stelmach, Premier Redford. Now Premier Dave Hancock is the interim premier. There'll be a new person coming in 6 months' time. To look at that and think that there's any kind of stability or any kind of strategic vision or any kind of direction going on in the PC party, I think they're very hard-pressed to be able to make the case to the public about why they deserve another chance. I think Albertans are getting increasingly frustrated that the agenda of our province has to constantly be put on the back burner while they sort out their political infighting. And that's where we are again. Every decision in government has come to a standstill. It's absolutely paralyzed.
Do you think there's actually going to be a snap election, or do you think with a new leader in place we'll be waiting the full 2 years?
Their past practice has shown when they elect a new leader, they hold the election within 6 months of it. That happened when Premier Klein came in. It happened with Premier Stelmach, and it also or Premier Stelmach took a little bit longer, but then Premier Redford had an election within 6 months as well. So we're preparing for the fact that we're very likely to see a snap election. And we'll be ready either way. We're already starting our election readiness process. We have been doing election readiness for months now, but we're now going to have to accelerate our candidate selection. And we'll make sure that we're ready, whether it's a year from now or 2 years from now.
It looks like the next 6 months and possibly 2 years or less will be rather interesting in Alberta. Danielle Smith, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks, Cormac.
And that was the leader of Alberta's Wild Rose Party, Danielle Smith, discussing the resignation of Premier Alison Redford.
Coming up, the Supreme Court rejects the Prime Minister's choice for a new judge on the top court's bench. A landmark decision from the Supreme Court of Canada as it rejects Prime Minister Stephen Harper's most recent appointment to the High Court. In the 6-1 ruling, the judges found that Marc Nadon, a semi-retired Federal Court of Appeal judge from Quebec, doesn't meet the specific requirements to be appointed as a Supreme Court justice for that province.
The High Court also struck down a key feature of the Conservative bill that last year amended the Supreme Court Act. Rocco Galati, the Toronto lawyer that launched the legal challenge, says he's pleased with this outcome.
The fact that the court has recognized that under Section 41 of the Constitution Act, it is constitutionalized and the government cannot alter the composition of the court without constitutional amendment. I'm very happy about that as a constitutional lawyer.
The Prime Minister's office isn't happy, though, sending out a statement saying it is genuinely surprised by the decision. It points out a former Supreme Court justice and a leading constitutional scholar supported the appointment. The government is now reviewing the decision and its options moving forward.
I'm joined by Emmett McFarland, Assistant Professor of Political Science at the University of Waterloo. He's also the author of the book Governing from the Bench, the Supreme Court of Canada and the Judicial Role. So Emmett, thanks for joining us. I guess, first of all, just if you could describe, what was your first reaction when you read the ruling?
I was quite a bit surprised. I had suspected that based on the fairly fast turnaround here, that the court was going to be able to avoid the constitutional questions and maybe even avoid having to reject Marc Nadon as sitting on the court. And, you know, there were a lot of reasons to suspect it would have been easier for the court to have tried to find a way out of this mess and avoid engaging with some of the questions that it ended up engaging with.
How, I guess this is obviously a pretty technical issue in terms of the court and in terms of who's eligible to sit there. What's sort of the easy, simple explanation of what happened today?
On the question of is Marc Nadon eligible, I think the simple answer is there are special requirements for judges from Quebec, that Quebec is entitled to special representation because of its distinct civil law system, and that those requirements include an up-to-date knowledge in the civil law, and that this is actually something that should be afforded constitutional protection on the court.
And so what happens now in terms of does the government have to find a new appointee? Is there some way they can get around this and still get Nadon on the court?
And that's a tricky thing, because where the majority landed, there is arguably a bit of a loophole in that, you know, theoretically, if Nadon had retired from the federal court, rejoined the Quebec bar for a day, on the majority's reasons, he might in fact have been eligible. The question of whether the Prime Minister or Mark Nadon, for that matter, are interested in testing that theory, I think is highly unlikely. I suspect the Prime Minister, if he's in a prudent mood, will in fact return to the shortlist and draw a new name from that.
How did we get here? You know, we've gone through an appointment process. We have this vacancy on the Supreme Court. Where exactly did a problem encounter, or is this just a matter of the Supreme Court finding a new rule that people hadn't been aware of, or is, you know, what exactly happened here?
I think the starting point for that is the Prime Minister's initial selection, which really surprised most people who observe this sort of stuff, and people who are familiar with the legal community at large. No one was expecting Mark Nadon's name to be announced. No one had him on their shortlists aside from, apparently, the Prime Minister's office. And it really was a unique choice, not just because it ended up running afoul of this specific eligibility rules, but because he was semi-retired. He was a supernumerary judge, which basically, you know, puts one foot out the door with respect to his standing on the federal court. And he was also, you know, he's known for his expertise in maritime law, not something that the Supreme Court deals a lot with. So no one saw it coming. And, you know, how and why the Prime Minister or the Minister of Justice kind of focused on Nadon is unfortunately something we might not get an answer to, because the entire process is so opaque. There's no transparency in how these decisions get made behind the scenes.
We have this process for looking at appointments. It's obviously nothing quite like what the United States has with their Supreme Court appointments. But we do have this process of a selection panel looking at candidates and providing a short list to the government, and then a day of hearings on the Hill with the appointee and a committee of parliamentarians. Does that process, should that process have caught this? Should that process have prevented this situation from happening?
It's hard to say, because that process is first of all very new. The first Supreme Court appointee to be interviewed by a parliamentary committee, or a committee of MPs rather, was 2006, Marshall Rothstein. And it's only been done a couple times since then. And the committee to kind of turn a long list into a short list is even more recent than that. And I think the problem with that process is that even with respect to that committee and it being an all-party committee, we actually don't know what goes on inside that committee. We're not even, when I say we, I mean citizens, don't even get to find out whether the committee was unanimous. Its members are not allowed to tell us. And so the idea that this secretive committee is going to, you know, be of a disciplined enough process to catch these fundamental errors, I think is highly questionable just in that light, in that who knows what questions were being raised by the opposition members. We will never get to know because of the secrecy. And I think that's an enormous problem.
So what happens, or what would you like to see happen going forward? Is there an idea or a model that you would look to and suggest for a more robust system that maybe catches something like this earlier?
Yeah, well, I think there are modest things we can do, and there are much more serious measures of reform that I think are worth debating. One thing we should be doing, in addition to interviewing publicly an appointee, is we should be interviewing publicly the Minister of Justice or whomever was actually involved in the decision-making process about why they chose a particular candidate, what they were looking for. That's a modest change. I mean, there are a lot of proposals for much more serious types of reform. At the lower court level, we have judicial appointing committees that actually have some independence from the government of the day, and that are much more inclusive and transparent in the advice that they seek from various aspects of the legal community. You know, whether something we want to replicate for the Supreme Court level might be debatable, but it's certainly worth looking into when you factor in the almost absolute discretion the Prime Minister holds right now, coupled with the total lack of transparency. It's a situation ripe for producing this type of case that we saw the court rule on today.
How you've studied this, you've written about it. How would you place this in the context of the history of the Supreme Court? How big a moment is today, and how big a moment is the entire situation of I guess the Mark Nadeau experience?
The court here for the first time elaborated on its own place within the Constitution, and in doing so, and in taking a fairly broad understanding of the composition of the court, that's the language in the Constitution, arguably the court has entrenched itself in a much more solid and permanent way than a more narrow interpretation would have allowed for.
And we would be remiss if we didn't mention that you wrote a piece for us at Macleans.ca, and I take it from that piece that you also think this may not bode well for the government side in the Senate reference.
Yeah, that's true. I think if the court takes a similar approach in terms of a fairly broad reading of the terms and concepts in the amending formula, then it's going to be very hard for it to arrive at a decision that Parliament alone can enact some of the reform measures with respect to the Senate that the Prime Minister would like to see. In other words, depending on the judges being consistent in their approach, it seems like the Prime Minister is going to need substantial provincial consent to get any major reforms of the Senate done.
Thank you, Emmett. I appreciate it.
No problem.
Once again, that was Emmett McFarlane, assistant professor of political science at the University of Waterloo and the author of the book Governing from the Bench, The Supreme Court of Canada and the Judicial Role.
It's now time for the Macleans panel, and I'm joined today by political editor Paul Wells and Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks.
Good to be here.
All right, first off, we're going to talk about Finance Minister Flaherty, or former Finance Minister Flaherty's resignation. How big of a loss is this to the Conservative front bench, and what was behind his resignation?
I think despite his denials, it's pretty clear that this had to do with the difficulty he's had on the health front for a little bit more than a year. He's tired, he's had a hard time focusing, and he really would have liked to keep on being finance minister indefinitely, but he finally decided that he would get this budget through the committee process and make sure that it was on its way to being implemented and actually having an effect on the nation's finances, and then he would ride off into the sunset. And, of course, that was more or less clear. It became clear the week when he introduced the budget, when he refused to be categorical on questions about whether he would introduce the next one, whether he would stick around, run again, things like that, where he previously had been categorical. So while it was a big surprise on the day, we've known that this was coming, or we've suspected strongly that it was coming for a couple months now.
And John, was he sort of pushed out by colleagues and family, or do you think he made that decision on his own?
Push is too strong a word. I'm with Paul that all signs would point to the fact that his family was concerned about his health. He's probably concerned himself. So I wouldn't say he was pushed. In fact, I think he had established a situation where he really could not be pushed. He was the one guy who could make his own decision on when he came and went from the Harper cabinet. I also think that the fact that Joe Oliver was named to replace him sets up a really interesting contrast. One thing we sometimes forget about Flaherty, because he was on the federal scene for so long, was that he was an experienced provincial politician in Ontario before this. Joe Oliver is not an experienced politician. He's a neophyte politician, an experienced Bay Street investment banker. But this is a guy who is now in a much bigger chair than he was in. Granted, he had an important job in natural resources, with the energy file being what it is here in Ottawa, but that is not the finance minister's job. The finance minister's job is a much bigger job, and he he really has to show that he can handle a different kind of heat now.
Was the decision for Oliver just to maintain some confidence until the next election on Bay Street?
I think that's exactly it. You've got an experienced guy with a business background who knows Toronto, obviously knows the business community very well, especially in the resource sector. And I think his role is analogous to John Manley's near the end of the Chrétien government, when Chrétien had to fire his finance minister and bring in a new guy. Manley has since said that it was not as hard as being a minister in a line portfolio, because the structures are very much in place. You've got a dynamite department working for you. The philosophy of the government is well entrenched, and I think that it'll be similar for Oliver. He's not inventing Harper conservatism. He's simply implementing it.
Paul, could I just add to that, though? It is interesting that Flaherty threw this problem into the mix on his last weeks on the job of coming out against income splitting. I do think that's been well covered, but I think it could be covered from here until next year, and I'd still find it interesting. That is unusual. A finance minister coming out against a signature policy at a point where it's very awkward for government, because they're coming up to that threshold where they will have surpluses, and they're supposed to, that promise is supposed to kick in. So no doubt Oliver, as if he's still in the chair when that moment comes, he's going to face an interesting position where people like us will be throwing Flaherty's quotes back in his face.
I was one of the many reporters standing outside Rideau Hall Wednesday morning waiting for Oliver to show up, freezing my buns
off.
That
must have been fun for you. You got a lot out of that, did you?
Yeah, not much.
And Paul and I were having coffee. When
yeah.
You were out there,
like, exercising pundit's prerogative.
That's right.
But after the swearing-in ceremony that wasn't announced to the media, Oliver and the other new ministers and the Prime Minister didn't answer a single question from the media gathered outside of Rideau Hall. Is this a sign of things to come, a new communication strategy possibly from the PMO leading up to 2015?
I do think that they decided last summer that amid all the Senate scandal and things like that, they were going to go to ground. They were going to add belts and suspenders to an already very restrictive media access strategy. In about the last 10 days, it seems to me, and in consultation with colleagues across the Hill, it seems to have reached a kind of a picturesque new extreme. I mean, there is almost nothing this government does that it will stop to explain to reporters this month. I expect that's unsustainable in an election campaign. I don't want to speculate on whether it will help them or hurt them, but it's making our job very interesting. This prime minister is in a lousy mood this month, and he is expressing it by not talking to us or not allowing most of the branches of government to talk to us.
And John, I want to switch gears here now to the Supreme Court decision to reject Marc Nadon as the appointment from Prime Minister Stephen Harper. What are the implications for the government?
Well, the first thing I would say about it is that it's been an interesting case study in how we view Supreme Court nominations, because when Justin Donald's nomination was announced, there was a tendency for people, both in the media and I would argue in the legal community as well, to assume that somehow it was fine, it would be okay. It's surprising how long it took for people to realize that there were serious questions about his eligibility for the job. It took a while because we're just used to the Supreme Court being sacrosanct, appointments process being understood to be a respectable thing. And it should be remembered, Prime Minister Harper has made several uncontroversial appointments before this. It's not like he set out to be the prime minister who rocked the Supreme Court appointment process. So all this has been quite interesting. In terms of implications, I'll be interested to hear what Paul has to say here, because in his book, he talks about the long history of people around Stephen Harper and in the conservative movement in the last couple of decades, feeling that there was a court party, that there was a sort of a tension between politicians and the bench. And I think that now comes to the fore.
I do believe that this was a case where Harper sought to make a conservative appointment on a mostly liberal court, and he will believe that he was blocked by the status quo. A lot of other observers, though, are noting that this was a pretty good day for Canadian federalism and the notion of Quebec as a distinct society, that the court said Quebecers are different and they have to be well represented according to not only the rules but the traditions of Quebec representation on the court, and this guy didn't cut it. So, but it is interesting. It's turning into just an extraordinary trend. Earlier this week, the feds got another refusal from the Supreme Court on an aspect of a parole law. They got an eight zero swat from the Supreme Court on their legal agenda. This government almost, it seems, cannot catch a break at the Supreme Court.
Can I just throw in there, though? Let's keep in mind as we think about this kind of stress, this kind of conflict, that there are a lot of Harper appointees on the Supreme Court. Of the six judges who rejected Nadon's appointment, three were put on the top court by Stephen Harper. So it does make it complicated to argue that somehow this is, say, a capital L liberal court, a court that somehow is inclined to be against Stephen Harper. I don't think that really. If you look at the names on the list, Cromwell, Karakansanis, judges like that, these are not people who are obvious liberals. So the people who are going to make that case are going to have to talk about the facts on the ground in the top court. This is a complicated situation, not a cut and dried case of conservatives versus liberals or something like that.
On the decision itself, Paul, it seems 6-1, and as some are coming out saying now, the rules were pretty clear to begin with. Why would the Prime Minister and his government try to push those boundaries?
I think it was worth a shot. I think it is true that he's appointed a bunch of judges who don't seem in their legal histories to be particularly conservative, and I think he decided he would try and put a real conservative, not just a Harper appointee, but a real conservative on the court and see how well it went. And they might also have hoped that this court would be a little sensitive about blocking a newcomer from arriving, because this court is, to some extent, an island of misfit toys. Whether you've got Rosie Abella, who was seen as some kind of loopy Toronto leftist wingnut, and there were Globe editorials to that effect when she went on the court, or Moldaver, whose French was deemed insufficient. There's very few judges on this court who were welcomed with open arms by public opinion when they got on, and I think the feds might have decided, surely these guys will let another eccentric among them, and it turned out they voted not on eccentricity but on the law.
Is this an indication, the ruling today, in any way on the Supreme Court reference on the Senate?
I would argue no, just because the cases are so different. The facts on the reference are, although it's very complicated, that most of the grounds that the government has taken to the Supreme Court and the way that they want to reform the Senate, I think the preponderance of legal opinion is that they're not going to win those cases. You know, they're not going to win those arguments. They might win on the idea of imposing term limits, but mostly they're not going to get their way. So I doubt that decision could be seen as somehow a slap to the government.
Thank you to Maclean's political editor Paul Wells and Ottawa bureau chief John Geddes for joining the panel.
Before we go, we want to tell you about an event that's sure to cause fireworks this coming week. On Wednesday, City News will be hosting the first televised mayoral debate in Toronto. All five major candidates will be taking part, including Mayor Rob Ford, former NDP MP Olivia Chow, and former Ontario PC leader John Tory. The two-hour special begins at 5 p.m. Eastern, and if you want to tune in online, you can visit citynews.ca or 680news.com.
Well, that's it for this week's episode. Thank you to former TD Bank Chief Economist Don Drummond, Alberta Wildrose leader Danielle Smith, and Emmett McFarlane, author and assistant professor of political science at the University of Waterloo. For more of your politics and power, join us next week on The Hill.